Back on the Mighty 690 KGGF, it's Wildcat Wednesday. It's joined back in studio, Barbara Ames and Jacob Weber. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking a little bit about the 4-H fairs going around the, county fairs, 4-H fairs all around. It's that time of the year right now. And Jacob, I think sure you wanted enough. To hit on a final note of your judging.
On judging exhibits at the county fairs, and I talked about judging open class, but there's a little difference when judging 4-H exhibits. This involves judging individuals, each individual exhibit, and there's the possibility that the 4-H'er can take their exhibit to the state fair. And so we have four ribbons that we award: blue, red, and white again. But to exhibit at the state fair, the 4-H exhibit has to earn a purple ribbon or a top blue in some fairs. So that's the judge's priority to determine which exhibitors can exhibit at the state fair. And that is a much more difficult level to achieve, to get a top blue or a purple. Each exhibit is judged on its own merit. It's not judged against any other exhibits within that class. So each exhibitor has the potential for earning a purple ribbon. And so that from that point on, we look at the exhibit, the judge may have a little sympathy for the exhibitor and maybe avoid giving out too many white ribbons. Red ribbons will be given out a little bit more frequently by the judge. Blue ribbons, it has to have the quality in order to get the blue. And for the purple ribbon, it has to be exceptional. It has to be according to the fair rules, number one, and it has to have the quality. And if there's artistic work involved, it has to have the artistic components of the exhibit. So the judge is going to be fair, try to be fair. When I judge, I make sure that I do not look at the name of the exhibitor. I never look at the name of the exhibitor because I don't want to be influenced by anybody's name. I look at the exhibit. I can make sure that it meets all the fair rules. I look for the quality. I look for other components within that exhibit, and then I make a decision. And sometimes I think maybe I've possibly made the wrong decision. I really have to think over things, especially when I'm looking at an exhibit and say, well, they did a pretty darn good job, but don't think it's quite good enough to go to the state fair. But on the other hand, they've done showed some really good talent. Possibly go ahead and let them have a purple ribbon anyway. But I don't like to go and judge a fair and not give any purples out at all, because I know there's going to be there's going to be some really good exhibitors. I don't want to go and have a whole bunch of red ribbons or even white ribbons. Occasionally, sometimes the exhibitor does not read the fair rules. And with some classes, it may require 12 items, like snap beans. It requires 12, and they only have 8. So I'll give it a participation ribbon. You can't really give it anything more than that. And then just with 4-H, I give reasons why I made that decision. And oftentimes I'll write those reasons down on a card and tell them what they need to do it better the next time. Occasionally with some fairs, we have what's called conference judging. And then you're talking straight to the 4-H'er.
I was going to ask you, do you ever do conference judging in the things you judge?
I have done conference judging several times. And then you really have to look at them in the eye and tell them, well, you didn't do a very good job, and this is what you need to do better. And you can see kind of, and some of them, the tears kind of welling up. And
But 4-H is about learning. It's a learning experience.
Exactly.
So they want it, they need to know why. And so they can do better next year.
And doing it in a constructive way as well. Like even having it on a piece of paper is a constructive way, because it's like, here's the issue, and here's a constructive way to get it done the correct way.
It's good just to ask the child, what do you think you could have done better? Are you satisfied with this?
Exactly. And I also like the fact, too, and I didn't know this, that there is kind of an advancement aspect to it. You know, I'm as competitive as could be, and you know, it's like, oh cool, like I might be able to go to the state fair because I put together something like that, and I think it was just an extra aspect to it that again I don't really realize. I'm new to the 4-H fair kind of thing. It was something that in my childhood I never grew up around, so it's neat to see. Certainly a lot of information on being a judge for the 4-H fairs, and as well as, you know, just keep yourself hydrated when you go out and spend some time there. But I know you wanted to hit on a couple of other things that you've been seeing around the area. Well,
dry weather is having an effect on plants. And, of course, the main thing that I'm concerned about is my vegetable garden and fruit garden. And so in that case, I've been irrigating. And I irrigate the plants that I feel are the most important: tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers. I've been irrigating some herbs like horseradish. I grow horseradish, so I don't want that to burn up. I like a good quality horseradish for Christmas. And I have some sweet potatoes. So those plants, they need adequate soil moisture. And the thing about irrigating is when it's so dry like this, you really have to maybe irrigate a little bit more often than what you think, because the surrounding soil is very dry. And within the soil profile, when you put water in one spot and the surrounding area is really dry, it's like a sponge. That water moves through the soil very rapidly away from plants. So you have to continually add water to it. That's why drip irrigation works so well, is because it's continually replenishing the moisture within the area of the root zone, and it's fairly efficient. With the other types of irrigation, we're going to moisten the soil thoroughly, but it's really would help if we could get the clouds to do the irrigation for us in an adequate level.
Certainly.
We keep having clouds, but not much coming out of them.
Yeah, they're not giving us too much juice out of it. Hopefully this weekend, it says about 50-60% chance of it coming up this weekend, and humidity levels higher. And again, you say that drip irrigation as well. That was all that we used when I grew up for like strawberries and the
you
fruit
grew,
like
you
that.
Grew up on a production farm then.
A little bit. We just had a nice big old garden in the back, and you know, whatever really my dad felt like throwing in that year. Well, he grew up in grew up in Montana, but he's from Perry, Iowa, so a little bit of a farm background for him.
Iowa is a good garden state as far as soil. They have excellent topsoil in that particular part of the world. A little bit better than what we got here, but we
deeper
have some
topsoil.
We got some topsoil here too. Compared to other areas, we have a fairly good topsoil, and always there's a room for soil improvement. But the dry weather certainly is having an effect on plants, and you can see it on a lot of trees now. They're dropping leaves. They're shedding those oldest leaves, those first leaves that came out on the trees, especially cottonwood. I noticed that a lot of them are popping their leaves off. And this is a response to the dry weather. And, of course, you know, it's baggage. It's extra baggage. Moisture is lost through those leaves. The tree just simply shuts them down. Not adequate moisture. It's a survival mode. If this goes on for an extended period of time, it puts a lot of stress on those trees. And then maybe 2 or 3 years down the road, we see other issues popping in. It's like hypoxylin canker on oaks and other trees. As a result of being exposed to excessive periods of drought, they have become more susceptible to infection. That doesn't mean that right now we should go out and irrigate the trees, because we don't have the irrigation resources to do that. We really need the rainfall to do it. So it might be something worthwhile remembering that we've had a period of drought stress this year. We might see some issues in the future. Another issue that we're looking at is see a lot of dead trees. Barbara mentioned there's a lot of dead trees that you're seeing around. Those mostly are elm trees that have died from Dutch elm disease. And I've really seen an increased number of Dutch elm disease incidents this year, mainly in trees out in the woods. Not so much in town, although I've seen a few of them in town that have succumbed to Dutch elm disease. And, of course, the American elm and the red elm, both of those are very susceptible to this disease. And essentially, we don't do anything about it other than get those trees removed as soon as possible, get them out of the landscapes, because they do serve as a source of inoculum for other elm trees nearby. And if we can get the sanitation, probably the best thing we can do. There's no treatment that we can recommend. There are some resistant varieties of American elms that are now available that people can plant, and those are really resistant. They tolerate the disease because they have been tested to make sure of that. They're propagated by grafting cuttings. They're propagated by cuttings. That way they have a true, definite resistance. Barb, do you have anything? I'm hogging the microphone. Okay, I'm looking at the time left and thinking Barb needs a little bit of air time here too.
10 minutes just flew by. Well, yeah, kind of going into it. But you were speaking a little bit more of an outbreak with something with a melon, correct?
Yeah, we've had. If you've been listening to the news, we've had a recent multi-state salmonella outbreak that's been linked to melons. Pre-cut melons that you buy at the store. And so that's just been kind of a reminder to me to remind people about safe handling and preparing your watermelon and cantaloupes and honeydews and how important that is. A lot of us buy these things at the store or the farmer's market, and we don't think about the fact that they do grow on the ground, so they're exposed to pests and microorganisms from the soil. And there have been outbreaks in the past. This is something that does happen. So it's important to look for melons when you go buy one, to look for one that doesn't have a lot of damage, because that damage can cause mold growth and let bacteria to travel inside the melon. And then wash your hands, wash your equipment, wash that melon off before you cut it. And sometimes we think, well, that's senseless because we're just going to cut that rind off of there. But if there's bacteria on the outside and you run that knife through, then it can take that bacteria to the inside of your melon. So wash those things off and get a vegetable brush and scrub those, and then go ahead and cut them. And once they're cut, you want to store them in a clean container in the refrigerator, and then label it with the date and discard it if it hasn't been eaten within about a week. So just a reminder to be careful there.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point as well, because, a watermelon, it's hard around the outside. Cantaloupe, hard around the outside. What's the use to wash it if I'm just going to cut it off and not eat it and things like that? And, it's a thin little knife that could potentially push down some bacteria and things that
that's
you didn't
right.
want. So
that's right.
Something we're speaking with Barbara Ames and Jacob Weber here. Final moments of Wildcat Wednesday. Any final notes that you guys wanted to hit on?
We'll see you at the fair.
See you at the fair.
Enjoy
especially.
That fair. Remember to stay hydrated and do some good hand washing while you're out there, too.
Certainly. Keep the hygiene up around the animals and stay hydrated as well. So Jacob Weber, Barbara Ames, thanks for spending your Wednesday with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for
Glad
hosting.
To be here.
This is the Mighty 690 KGGF.